Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. War in Ukraine risks seeing 90% of the country freefall into poverty and extreme vulnerability, nearly 3 weeks since Russia invaded its neighbor, a new UN report said on Wednesday. Apart from the heavy civilian death toll as Ukrainian cities have been pounded by Russian shelling, the UN Development Programme, UNDP, cited government estimates that at least $100 billion worth of buildings, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools and other vital infrastructure have been destroyed. One in two Ukrainian businesses have shut down completely, while the other half has been forced to operate well below capacity. UNDP warned that if the conflict drags on, and if more support to the country is not forthcoming quickly, it could wreck almost 2 decades of economic progress. To help prevent these shocks and protect hard-won development gains, we need peace now, said UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner. Early UN estimates indicate that nearly 3 in 10 people in Ukraine need life-saving assistance. Based on the current direction of the fighting, 18 million people will likely be affected, and more than 7 million may have to flee their homes. A funding crunch has put millions of people in Yemen at risk of catastrophe, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres said on Wednesday, in support of a $4.3 billion appeal to fund the relief effort in the war-torn country. After more than 7 years of war, tens of thousands of civilians, including at least 10,000 children, have died, Mr. Guterres said, adding that for millions of internally displaced people, life is a daily struggle for survival. Today, more than 23 million Yemenis face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing, according to the UN Humanitarian Coordination Office, OCHA. To make matters worse, a lack of funding has forced the UN and partners to scale back or close around two-thirds of life-saving projects, Mr. Guterres said. He warned that food rations have just been reduced for 8 million people and that this has had devastating consequences. In the coming weeks, nearly 4 million people in major cities may also lose access to safe drinking water, and 1 million women and girls may lose access to reproductive health services, which the UN chief described as a death sentence in a country where one woman dies every 2 hours from complications during pregnancy and childbirth. After a consistent decrease in the number of new COVID-19 cases globally since the end of January, last week saw a rise of 8%, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned on Wednesday. More than 11 million new cases and just over 43,000 new deaths were reported between the 7th and 13th of March, with over 455 million confirmed cases and over 6 million deaths from the coronavirus overall. Regionally, the Western Pacific saw the highest increase in new weekly cases of 29%, followed by Africa at 12%, but infections dropped by 20% or more in the Eastern Mediterranean, Southeast Asia, and the Americas. The highest numbers of new cases were reported in the Republic of Korea, with more than 2.1 million infections, up 44%, followed by Vietnam and Germany. The highest death toll over the past week was reported in the United States, where more than 9,000 people died, a 13% decrease from the previous 7-day period. Russia reported more than 4,500 new deaths from coronavirus, which is a 15% decrease, while Brazil confirmed more than 3,300 COVID fatalities, also down 15%. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University and director of the university's nuclear studies program.
Nuclear war is a central question facing all of us right now. Stay tuned.
We also speak today with Professor Karina Mullen, a political economist.
What are the nuts and bolts behind all of what's going on now in Ukraine? She knows. Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
The Nuremberg Tribunal called aggression, quote, the supreme international crime, end quote, because it contains within it all other crimes. German Nazi leaders were tried, convicted, and hung at Nuremberg for the German War of Aggression. They began in September of 1939 when they invaded Poland and started World War II. The guilty verdicts at Nuremberg were not merely victor's justice. Its precepts were incorporated into the UN Charter. The Charter, which is a treaty ratified by the countries of the world, established a process for keeping the peace and, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, close quote. War is outlawed, with the only exception being self-defense after an armed attack or with the permission of the Security Council of the United Nations. Russia is guilty of aggression against the Ukraine. But that being said, the United States has baited the Russian bear repeatedly, starting in 1990 with the breakup of the Soviet Union. At that time, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker promised the Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev that the U.S.-led NATO organization would not move, quote, one inch, close quote, east towards Russia. This promise was broken. The Russians were betrayed. Since then, NATO has recruited 11 former Soviet bloc and Warsaw Pact countries into its military organization. Led by the United States, NATO is an organization that has played an aggressive role, having carried out the bombings of Serbia, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and Libya. NATO has placed missiles in Poland within 100 miles of the Russian border. Missiles on the long border between the Ukraine and Russia could hit Moscow in 10 minutes, making it impossible for the Russians to defend themselves. Russia's attempt to make the United States understand they have crossed a red line has been consistently rejected. This is not to defend Russia's actions, but to place them in historical context. The world now has come to the edge of an abyss. A nuclear war could easily be started, annihilating all of humanity. The rule of law must be restored. Russia must honor a ceasefire and withdraw. The United States must forswear arming Ukraine and recruiting Ukraine into NATO. Ukraine must go forward as a neutral country like Austria or Finland. Today, we speak with Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University and directs the Nuclear Studies Program there. Peter and Oliver Stone wrote the book, The Untold History of the United States, and also produced a Showtime documentary series based on the book. Peter Kuznick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you today.
Peter, the world's facing the most dangerous crisis since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. What are the parallels between that crisis and the current situation in Ukraine? What's the current risk of nuclear war?
Yeah, the parallels is that the world is on the brink of nuclear war again. And as you say, it's the closest we've been to war, world war, and nuclear war in 60 years. You know, there are some parallels, but one of the ones that strikes me as least similar is that in 1962, the U.S. had between a 10-to-1 and a 20-to-1 advantage over the Soviet Union in the number of nuclear weapons, the number of bombers that could hit the other country, and the number of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. In the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, especially after Kennedy and Khrushchev were off the scene by 1964, the decision in Moscow was to never be in a position of weakness again where it would have to back down because it was so outgunned. And Russia, Soviet Union, moved quickly for nuclear parity. And that's the case now. You know, so we have a situation where Russia is actually the biggest nuclear power in the world. Russia, again, after the U.S., you know, some context on some of this. In 2001, after the U.S. was hit on 9/11, the first international leader to reach out to the United States and offer support was Vladimir Putin. But the U.S. response was to kick Putin and Russia in the teeth. In 2002, the United States abrogated the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the ABM Treaty. In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq over the objections not only of Germany and France, but very strongly over Russia. In 2004, Russia expanded NATO dramatically for a second time, including the Baltic states on Russia's borders. Then in 2007, Putin makes his famous speech at the Munich Security Conference, in which he deplores American unipolarity, deplores American hypermilitarism, and says that he's no longer going to tolerate any further NATO expansion, that this is his red line. How did the U.S. respond to that? In 2008, George W. Bush announces that he wants to put Ukraine and Georgia on a fast track for joining NATO. That was in many ways the provocation that really began a lot of what's happening now. William Burns, our current CIA director, was then U.S. ambassador to Russia. Burns wrote back a memo to the White House titled, "Niet means Niet. Don't cross Russia's red lines." This is what American statesmen and policymakers have been saying for years. Don't cross Russia's red lines when it comes to NATO expansion, especially Ukraine and Georgia. But the U.S. did, and Russia responded by invading Georgia in 2008. And then after the Maidan uprising in 2014 and Russia seizing Crimea and supporting the rebellions in Luhansk and Donetsk, this continued. And in 2018, in Putin's State of the Nation address, he announced that Russia now has 5 new nuclear weapons, all of which can circumvent U.S. missile defense. He said, "You didn't listen to us. Listen to us now." And yet we still didn't listen. And we can go into a lot of the history, but in 2019, when Zelensky got elected president with 70% of the vote in Ukraine, he did so on a platform of wanting to reach out to Russia, resolve the tensions, go back to the Minsk II agreement from 2015 and resolve the crisis between them that way. And when he started to reach out to Russia, he got hit so hard by the nationalists inside Ukraine that he had to back down. And then it was at that point that he started to welcome in more and more NATO armaments, more and more NATO trainers, speak negatively about Russia, and then demand Ukrainian admission to NATO in a much more voluble way. So in 2018, Russia announces its 5 new nuclear weapons. Once this crisis began, and especially the latest phase, Putin started to make threats about using nuclear weapons, and threatening the West if they got militarily involved, they were going to see destruction of a kind that they had never experienced before. Then he put his nuclear forces on high alert. Then he began the attack the attack at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, the largest nuclear plant in all of Europe, and starting a fire to the adjacent building that created the danger of a breach of the containment potentially and the spreading of massive amounts of nuclear radioactive waste throughout Europe and Russia. That would have been extraordinarily dangerous. And even yesterday, the Ukrainian foreign minister was warning that the Chernobyl plant had power had been cut off to Chernobyl, that they lost communication with the workers there, and that he feared an imminent catastrophe. There are about 20,000 spent fuel rods stored at that plant, have to be maintained with water to cool them on a regular basis. And so if the electricity was cut off, the fear was that the water would not circulate, and they'd spend fuel ponds and keep the rods cool, and the reaction could occur. The head of the IAEA gave assurances that this would take weeks before the catastrophe was realized, but it was another wake-up call. And then you put that all together with the fact that Putin has his control over 6,000 nuclear weapons, and that he's been sounding increasingly irrational, unhinged, out of touch with reality. His statements leading up to the invasion, saying that, first of all, that there was a genocide going on in the Donbass. There was no genocide going on in the Donbass. We know what genocide is. There was aggression going on there. There was shelling, but it was far from genocide. Saying that that Ukraine was run by neo-Nazis and drug dealers? Lunacy. Saying that Ukraine was always part of Russia? I mean, there's a big history there is much more complicated. So people did not know if Putin has simply lost his grasp on reality. We know that he's surrounded by yes men, that he doesn't tolerate any dissent. He doesn't have anybody around him to challenge him. Now, we saw those visuals of him sitting 20, 30 feet away from the closest people he was talking to in all those meetings. You know, nobody knows how much of a grasp of reality the guy still has. And the fact that somebody in that position, at a time when militarily things are obviously not going well for him in Ukraine, at a time when he's politically isolated, when there's a crisis in his own country, the fact that he's got access to 6,000 nuclear weapons is and should be terrifying. And so that's in terms of the nuclear dangers. And if this spills over, if it spills over to Poland or Romania, countries that are supplying arms to Ukrainians at this point, you know, we don't know what Russia is willing to do to interdict that, to stop those flow of arms. And so if Russia does bomb on purpose or inadvertently Poland or Romania, does that trigger Article 5? Does NATO get involved militarily? And the fact that Zelensky had until now been calling for no-fly zone and getting support from some hawks in the United States, as well as some former military officials in the United States, I mean, that is lunacy. You know, the Americans have shown, and what we're willing to do, that many American leaders are willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. And now with Zelensky's call for a no-fly zone, the Ukrainians have shown that they're willing to fight to the last American and to the last person on Earth. Because, you know, fortunately, Biden did not go for that. And Zelensky, as a result, has been sounding like he's much more willing to compromise right now, which is positive. And I hope that something proceeds along those lines, because this is just, aside from the humanitarian catastrophe being suffered by the people of Ukraine, which is heartbreaking to watch, aside from that, the implications in terms of involving the world in a much bigger and far more dangerous crisis are just terrifying. And that's why this has got to be stopped, and stopped immediately.
Peter, of course, a no-fly zone would mean that we would start shooting down Russian planes, and that would be, I think, the catastrophe you're talking about. But how do you think the situation in Ukraine could be de-escalated and defused? Do you think we should call for an immediate ceasefire, the withdrawal of Russian troops, no NATO in Ukraine, and the neutralization of Ukraine, say, along the lines of Austria or Finland?
I'm with you on all of those. I think that's part of the answer, or that's most of the answer. And that's what Putin has been saying that he wanted from the beginning. He wanted neutralization of Ukraine. He wanted a guarantee Ukraine would not join NATO. He didn't want any further NATO expansion to the east. He wanted recognition of the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk, the breakaway republics, and he wanted agreement on Crimea. The interesting thing is that Zelensky, in his March 7th ABC interview, said that, I quote him, he says, "I've cooled down regarding the question a long time ago after we understood that NATO was not prepared to accept Ukraine." So he basically said he's willing to accept that Ukraine joining NATO is off the table. He also said in that interview that he's willing to accept neutral status, that he's willing to negotiate the independence of the Donbass republics, and that he didn't say that he's willing to go along with Crimea, but they can agree to disagree about that. So he's effectively given in on almost all of Putin's most fundamental demands. So I think that we're a lot closer now than we were even 2 or 3 days ago to the possibility of a resolution along those lines. You know, many of us were saying that before this even began. I must have done 75 interviews on Russian TV in the 3 months leading up to this war. And my message to Putin was declare victory, you know, and remove those troops. Diffuse the tension. Start the diplomacy. The world has finally, after 30 years, been talking about and understanding the seriousness of Russia's national security concerns. NATO expansion to include Ukraine and Georgia was off the table. That was not going to happen probably in Putin's lifetime. NATO and the U.S. were talking about compromising and negotiating about missile deployments in Europe, about military exercises, about transparency. Putin was in a position to declare victory and to send those troops back to their barracks. This was, if there was ever an unnecessary war, this was it. But Zelensky would not say this before when he had a chance, even though I urged him to do so. Biden and NATO would not say this before when they had a chance, even though it was obvious that this was the way to prevent the war, which is obvious, which is so horrific and catastrophic. And so, I mean, this whole thing could have been avoided. Now, it's, you know, had the United States done what Zelensky had been demanding and given more armaments and given the fighter jets and more Stingers and drones, then maybe Putin would have acted sooner. You know, it might not have been to Ukraine's advantage to get that or to demand that. The other problem was the United States and NATO, while not giving any security guarantees to Ukraine, and whereby saying that we would not get involved, were still egging Zelensky on to resist. There was a strong faction in the United States who saw this as the West's opportunity to take down Russia further, to weaken Russia, to discredit Russia, to turn Russia into more of a pariah state, to cripple Russia's economy. And I don't think they anticipated that the Russian military would be so inept, so incompetent. But I thought that they could really weaken Russia in other ways. And so there were many people who welcomed this, in the same sense that in 1979, Brzezinski's whole goal toward Russia and Afghanistan was to induce Russia into invading. I mean, Brzezinski started to arm and fund and support the Mujahideen. He said to Carter, this is going to force Russia to intervene, and we're going to be able to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. And so even though publicly they decried this and said this is a horrible thing, Russian aggression, privately they broke out the champagne and they were celebrating. I don't think a lot of these people give a crap about what's happening to the Ukrainians. And I think that they would rather, in a geopolitical sense, use this to further weaken Russia. But those of us who really care about the Ukrainian people, who really care about war and peace, who really want to see a peaceful and prosperous world, have got to do everything we can to end this fighting as quickly as possible before the chance of this spilling over into a much bigger conflict continue.
Peter, what is the extent of U.S. military power in terms of its nuclear arsenal, number of foreign bases, and the strength of its Army, Navy, and Air Force? How does Russia and the rest of the world measure up to this immensity?
Nobody's got military power at all comparable to the United States. I mean, we saw, even in Afghanistan and Iraq, the U.S. can blow things up. The U.S. military can destroy a country in very, very quick order. Occupying a country and rebuilding a country is something else that we're not capable of doing. But the United States budget, military budget, is about 10 times the size of Russia's military budget. And now you've got these calls. Some of these loonies are calling for doubling U.S. military spending. They can't find money for schools. They can't find money for child care. They can't find money for building homes. They can't find money for so many human needs, but they can always find money that'll end up in the coffers of the defense contractors, or as they're more appropriately called and were called after World War I, the merchants of death. And so that's one of the consequences of this. But the U.S. military, I think that one of the lessons that we're learning from this is that so much of that money that went into modernizing the Russian military was probably siphoned off into these yachts and these coffers of these corrupt billionaires, because the Russian military is not very efficient. Not, and the command and control of this operation seems to be pathetic. This convoy, 40-mile convoy, that's been on the road to Kyiv for more than a week and has been stalled because of the logistics, because of supply lines, looks very, very, very weak and disorganized. The Russians are taking some heavy casualties already. Now, we know that the Russians have not deployed much of their forces. They've got a lot of materiel and hardware and other things that they can do, and far more soldiers they can throw into this. But this has given the Russian military a real black eye. The United States, under Obama, you know, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his Prague speech, supposedly calling for nuclear abolition, actually saying that the United States will not be the first country to give up its nuclear weapons, the United States will be the last country to do so. Obama should give back that Nobel Peace Prize and apologize. But one of the worst things he did was to inaugurate this 30-year, trillion-dollar nuclear modernization program designed to make America's nuclear weapons more efficient and more lethal. Now we know it's going to cost at least $1.7 trillion. But it's underway. But the U.S., we don't know what the effectiveness of Russia's nuclear arsenal is. There's every reason to suspect that they could wipe out the United States and anybody else they wanted to. I wouldn't gamble on the fact that the incompetence that we're seeing on the ground in Ukraine now would also carry over to the nuclear realm. You have to realize all it takes to cause a nuclear winter. When Sagan and the scientists in the 1980s were warning about the effects of nuclear war in terms of triggering nuclear winter on the across the planet, they actually overestimated the threshold for nuclear winter. The latest scientific studies show that a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, would burn the cities, send up so much smoke, soot, and debris into the atmosphere that it would circle the stratosphere within 2 weeks, block the sun's rays from hitting the Earth. The temperatures on the surface of the Earth would plummet. Much of the agriculture would be destroyed, and up to 2 billion people could be killed. That's 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. The world has approximately 13,000 nuclear weapons, and they're not Hiroshima-sized. Most are between 7 and 70 times the size of the Hiroshima bombs. So just do some of the math, and you can figure out how vulnerable we are as a planetary species. And right now, there are two people who've got veto power over the future existence of life on our planet. Joseph Biden, who's exercising a measure of restraint, at least, and Vladimir Putin, who's behaving as if he's unhinged. So we're in a precarious situation, but the U.S. strength is enormous. The U.S. still has an empire of approximately 800 bases around the world. My friend and colleague David Vine has been writing about that brilliantly for quite some time. But the U.S. has got enormous capabilities. We don't need to keep on feeding this vast death machine that we've created. We've already got everything we would ever need to defend ourselves and defend our allies, but not against a nuclear power. Because, you know, one of the sad things that's come out of this, I did an interview yesterday with Japanese media, because former Prime Minister Abe and many others, including leaders of the LDP, the ruling party there, and some of the leading alternative parties, are calling for nuclear sharing with the United States inside Japan. Japan, the most anti-nuclear country in the world. Japan, the victim of America's two atomic bombs in 1945. Japan, with the Article 9 of its peace constitution, with its three anti-nuclear principles, is now a strong faction there is saying that the mistake that Ukraine made was giving up its nuclear weapons, and that Japan doesn't want to be in that position vis-a-vis Russia or China or North Korea. This is the kind of insanity that's being provoked by this invasion. And I think that if it's happening that way in Japan, it's going to happen that way elsewhere too. And you know, and the tragic thing is that there is some truth to that insanity. That the point that North Korea made when the U.S. invaded Iraq, the North Korean official newspaper said the mistake that Saddam Hussein made was not having nuclear weapons. If he'd had nuclear weapons, the U.S. could never have invaded. And I think he was probably right in terms of North Korea, might have been right in terms of Ukraine. That's not the world we want to live in, because we know that the more countries have nuclear weapons, the greater the risk of those nuclear weapons being used. Biden, give him credit, when this began, he said the U.S. is not going to send troops, the U.S. is not going to fight Russia, and that he canceled the ICBM test last week because he doesn't want to give any additional provocation. That's the exact right thing to have done, you know, but now we've got to get on the same page and begin and end this before any of this happens.
Peter, unfortunately, we've run to the end of our allotted time. I wanted to ask you the big, big question on how we prevent the spread of nuclear arms, and we haven't got there. So I'd like, on behalf of Marjorie and myself, to invite you to come back to talk about that key, key question. And in the meantime, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work?
Well, I'm doing interviews constantly, which, you know, anybody who asks me, I'm more than happy to do it. One of the things I've been stressing is the need for China to take the lead on these negotiations. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that some more also, because I see that as the only viable off-ramp. Xi Jinping is the only one with actual leverage over Putin. And I mean, I could go in depth, but it'll take a little while. People can email me at Kuznick, K-U-Z-N-I-C-K, at American.edu. And I just write and try to do interviews and webinars every chance I get, because the world needs more historical perspective. And we can't solve these problems unless we understand what caused them, how we got to this point, and what's been the effect of 30-plus years of American attempt to gain unipolarity and how that's created an unbalanced world.
Peter, thank you so much for your interview and giving listeners a perspective that they don't get, certainly not in the corporate media, but we really look forward to having you back soon.
I'd love to do that. Thanks.
Peter, thank you so much. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
He's 5 foot two and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the red, he says it's for the peace.
Horrific images of the war in Ukraine, and now more than 2 million displaced persons streaming over Ukraine's border, continue to emerge. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is calling for a no-fly zone over Ukraine, and the corporate media is hyping more punishing sanctions against Russia. So far, Joe Biden has resisted calls for a no-fly zone, apparently mindful that enforcing a no-fly zone would mean the U.S. Air Force shooting down Russian planes and bombing Russian ground installations that provide Russian forces with anti-aircraft support. That could well devolve into a nuclear confrontation. The United States and other Western countries have imposed sanctions against Russia, including expelling some Russian banks from the SWIFT financial messaging system, essentially barring them from international transactions and effectively blocking Russian exports and imports, as well as banning imports of Russian oil and gas. But these sanctions harm not the Russian oligarchs, but the Russian people, while raising gas prices for people in the United States. The prospect of cyber warfare lurks in the background, which could redound to the detriment of people around the world, including those of us in the United States. Meanwhile, the U.S. and its allies continue to send massive armaments to Ukraine to the delight of the huge military contractors. While Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine constitutes illegal aggression prohibited by the UN Charter, it is necessary to analyze the history and geopolitics, as well as the role NATO has played in the region, in order to understand both the context for the conflict and how it could have been prevented. Today, we are fortunate to have with us on Law and Disorder Radio, Corina Mullen, an organizer and professor of political science and political economy at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Brooklyn College, CUNY, in New York. Corina is a member of the steering committee of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism, Sanctions, Blockades, and Economic Coercive Measures. Corina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Corina, please give us some background for the war in Ukraine. What role has NATO played? Why is Russia so insistent that Ukraine doesn't join NATO? Why did Vladimir Putin say on February 21st, if Ukraine was to join NATO, it would serve as a direct threat to the security of Russia? Has NATO outlived its original purpose?
Thanks for that, Marjorie. I just want to begin by saying how worried I am as someone committed to global justice and peace, as both you and Michael are as well, and the program itself. So how worried I am by the current conjuncture, and in particular by the possibility of nuclear war that the crisis in Ukraine seems to be moving us closer to. So the NATO militarization of Europe and the Russian intervention, I think, really highlight that the world has reached this dangerous fork in the road. Our concerns, of course, must be with the poor and working class, who are always the primary victims of the dislocation, destruction, and death of war, with those in Ukraine facing direct bombing, as well as the indiscriminate bombing of people in the Donbas region, who have really endured years of state repression and neo-Nazi attacks, and the working class Russian people now facing crushing sanctions. And I also just want to point out and highlight the mass refugee exodus that's been prompted by this crisis, and particular the experience of African, Asian, and other racialized migrants living in Ukraine who have been subjected to the racist treatment at the hands of Ukrainian and Polish officials and undermined by the racist logics and physical, psychological, and environmental violence of militarized imperialist borders, which remind us really of the need to respect international law and basic humanity and honoring the rights of all people, regardless of race and nationality, to freedom of movement and to seek asylum. So I also want to mention, and this is connected to the question of NATO, how discussions of Russian aggression in the mainstream media and by U.S. politicians have tended to obscure the U.S.'s own history of violence, including, of course, over 400 years of slavery and settler colonial genocide, dispossession of indigenous lands, as well as interventions across the globe. we know that the U.S. has been responsible for overthrowing countless foreign governments, dropping countless numbers of bombs on countless numbers of countries, assassinating countless numbers of leaders, suppressing popular movements, interfering in democratic elections, and of course the U.S. maintains close to 800 military bases in more than 70 countries. And so another aspect regarding these distortions in the media depictions, I'd like to highlight specifically how it weaponizes amnesia around, for example, NATO's enlargement, and tries to confuse us about the directionality of cause and effect in order, as you know, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman famously put it, to manufacture consent around never-ending war, which of course is a staple of this country's political economy. It should be stated from the outset that not only is NATO a central tool of U.S. imperialism in Eastern Europe, but across the globe more generally. NATO is a Cold War institution that was designed to counter the Soviet Union and undermine the prospects for communism and self-determination globally. Some of its earliest interventions were to prop up colonial regimes like Portugal and France in the face of anti-colonial revolutions on the African continent. Although NATO is a Cold War institution, there was actually an uptick in its military operations after the Cold War, and including, of course, interventions in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, and the leading role it played in the 2011 military intervention and regime change in Libya. NATO, which we know is led by the U.S., has been steadily expanding eastward in Europe for decades, contrary to assurances made to Russia and contrary to the demands of workers across Europe. In the absence of any threat to itself, NATO has expanded from 16 to 28 members in the post-Cold War period, bordering Russia on the Baltic coast and threatening to encircle it entirely. NATO has, since the fall of the Soviet Union, become Europe's main foreign policy-making body. And even to the point of dominating domestic economic interests. NATO requires member states to maintain high levels of military spending. The current agreed target for European NATO members is 2% of GDP spent on defense by 2024. In 2020, 10 NATO countries, including the U.S., reached or exceeded the 2% target, two more than in 2019, including for the first time France and Norway. And in doing this, NATO secures the central place of the military-industrial complex in the global capitalist economy and ensures the profitability of never-ending war. So when thinking of NATO, we also need to consider it more than just its members, more than just its direct interventions, more than just its expansion eastward in Europe and increasingly encroaching on Russian borders. There are also the non-NATO military alliances with the U.S. that many people don't know about. 20 countries are currently designated major non-NATO allies from across the globe, and that includes Brazil, Bahrain, Egypt, the Philippines, Thailand, and Tunisia. These relationships also result in the increased militarization of states and borders, increased spending on militaries versus productive and development sectors on the economy or in public goods like healthcare, housing, and education. And also, although through requiring Global South states who are members to engage in U.S.-led military and security trainings, intelligence sharing, and other forms of imperialist unequal partnership, they break down possibilities for Global South solidarity and alternative ways of imagining security and really the potential for decolonizing international relations.
For those who have tuned in late, we're speaking with Corina Mullen, who's a professor here at CUNY in New York City. Corina, what role did the United States play in the 2014 coup in the Ukraine? How did that coup lead to the present situation?
Right. So to understand the current crisis, we need to go back a little bit further to at least 1991 and understand the active military force and aggression the U.S. has used against Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. Although, of course, we can't understand even the fall of the Soviet Union without understanding U.S. constant aggression and attempts to undermine the Russian Revolution. So NATO's expansion has been a well-known security concern for Russia since 1999, when Bill Clinton inaugurated the official process of growing NATO's membership to include former nations of the Warsaw Pact, despite promises made that this would not happen. So instead, the U.S. Policy executed by Bill Clinton and subsequent administrations was to wage a new military expansion via NATO, further militarizing the region and expanding U.S.'s sphere of domination. So since 1999, NATO has absorbed 14 Eastern European countries, including Estonia and Latvia, which share borders with Russia. But the more immediate causes of this crisis include the consistent prodding of Russia since 2008, when NATO put the inclusion of Ukraine and Georgia, both bordering Russia, on the table. And then they also include, and this brings me to the coup, the U.S. and EU NATO-backed coup in 2014 against Viktor Yanukovych, against a democratically elected government that was opposed to the country's subservient relationship with the EU and positioned Ukraine, which shares a 1,200-mile border with Russia, as a neutral country. The coup replaced the elected government with a government that made NATO membership a policy mandate. So since 2019, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has repeatedly requested Ukraine's entrance into NATO. NATO's eastward expansion has enabled a hostile military alliance to blanket the region with missiles pointed to reach targets in Russia within, some people say, less than 10 minutes. The U.S. has never abandoned its provocative posture while the Russian government's appeals to address its security concerns have fallen on deaf ears. So during his time in office, also Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces and Open Skies Treaty. Those are two agreements that were aimed at limiting U.S. and Russian nuclear weapon deployments and securing a lasting peace among signatory parties. Under Biden, the U.S. has continued to push for the expansion of NATO. With the help of Israel, the U.S. Has armed, trained, and funded the Ukrainian military, including its neo-Nazi and far-right elements, as it has prosecuted an eight-year war on the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, including laws compelling the use of Ukrainian as part of a systematic attack on ethnic Russians. It has also actively sought to undermine Russian economic development and relations with EU nations, such as the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project with Germany. And the goal of punishing, rather, Russia, rather than averting a conflict, was apparent on February 26, when Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky opted out of negotiations over neutral status with Russia and kept Ukraine fighting, most certainly under U.S. pressure.
Karina, please explain the role of imperialist economic policies and interventions, for example, by the EU and U.S.-dominated International Monetary Fund in Ukraine following the fall of the Soviet Union, but particularly after the 2014 coup, and the social, political, economic impact this had.
Right. Thanks for that question. So in addition to the role of NATO, we can't understand the 2014 coup and current crisis without looking at the U.S. strategy to open Ukrainian markets to foreign investors and to give control of its economy to giant multinational corporations. This is an element, I think, that's often lacking from even left analysis of what's happening in Ukraine. As the political economist Prabhat Patnaik has argued, where the general role of the IMF is to open up economies around the world for the penetration of metropolitan capital by making them investor-friendly through the adoption of a host of anti-working class and anti-people, so-called austerity measures involving the taking over of natural resources and land areas by metropolitan capital. Ukraine is one of the examples where the IMF has directly supported the U.S. government's Cold War objectives. The IMF, which leverages aid loans to push governments to adopt policies friendly to foreign investors, the IMF is funded by and represents Western, especially U.S., financial capital and governments, and has been at the forefront of efforts to reshape economies around the world for decades, leading to increased debt and dependency in the global south and reinforcing global hierarchies in the international system. So in the Ukraine, the IMF had long planned to implement a series of economic reforms to make the country more attractive to investors. These included cutting wage controls, so for example, lowering wages, privatizing and reducing government spending on health and education sectors, which made up the bulk of employment in Ukraine, and cutting natural gas subsidies to Ukrainian citizens that made energy affordable to the general public. Those involved in the 2014 coup, like U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, repeatedly stressed the need for the Ukrainian government to act these so-called necessary reforms. In 2013, after early steps to integrate with the West, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych turned against these changes, as I mentioned earlier, and ended trade integration talks with the EU. Months before his overthrow, he restarted economic negotiations with Russia in a major snub to the Western economic sphere. So the U.S. was upset with Yanukovych's audacity to turn to Russia instead of the IMF, and they decided to restrict further damage to their interests, and that is a large part of why he was overthrown in this U.S.-sponsored coup. And these elements, and especially thinking about the neo-Nazi elements who were involved in that coup, have now become, of course, formally incorporated into the Ukrainian army through the inclusion of it in the Azov Battalion. The resistance, also it should be said, to the Maidan coup has continued from 2014 to today. And after the coup, the new government quickly restarted the EU deal. After cutting heating subsidies in half, it secured a $27 billion commitment from the IMF. The IMF's general goals include reducing the role of the state in economies in order to open them up, as I said, to Western finance, and therefore generate greater dependency on the imperialist core, as well as to de-develop economies and to cheapen labor. The political economist I mentioned earlier, Prabhat Patnaik, in a recent article points out this huge IMF loan to the Ukraine was notable for several reasons. First, it was much larger, in fact, more than six times than the IMF would normally provide in a comparable situation. Second, it was given to a country in the midst of civil war, which is against usual IMF practice. And third, this is what makes it comparable to the kinds of loans that the IMF gives to Global South states on a regular basis. It was known from the very beginning that the loan could not possibly be paid back, so that the only means through which it could be sought to be recovered would be through metropolitan capital taking control of the country's land and mineral resources, the most prominent of which is natural gas. The so-called structural adjustment policies that the IMF imposes entail the dismantling of all trade and capital controls, privatization of public assets. So after the 2014 coup, for example, the US-EU IMF-backed government attempted to privatize almost all of its 30 ore deposits, which is pretty unprecedented, and also introduced so-called labor market flexibility, which means basically attacking trade unions, which is probably one of the reasons, I think, that the trade union building in Odessa was targeted by neo-Nazi firebombing. I think more than 40 people were killed during the 2014 coup as a kind of disciplinary measure. It also explains the crackdown on the left, as the government that took power in Ukraine in the wake of the U.S.-backed so-called Euromaidan coup of 2014 outlawed the Communist Party and banned it from running candidates in elections. The party's youth group was also made illegal, and its members were subjected to political persecution by the police and in the courts.
Marina, how should the conflict in Ukraine be resolved? What does Russia want? What is Ukraine likely to agree to in negotiations? And what role, if any, should the Minsk agreements play in a settlement?
Yes. I think we need to consider what are the main interests motivating the U.S. in this escalation, and that, I think, relates to what kind of settlement we can imagine coming out of this. So, of course, the main interest, I think, motivating the U.S. in this escalation of aggression is the fear of losing its economic and political hold on their NATO allies and other countries in the region under its sphere of influence. As many have seen, their major opportunities for gain to lie in increasing trade and investment with China and Russia. Ultimately, I think it's also about blocking the possibility of Eastern and maybe even Western Europe from breaking away from NATO and U.S. dominance, and of the emergence of a new multipolar world order centered on economic integration and economically integrated Eurasia, including China and Russia. Some analysts have argued that the long-term dream of the U.S., new Cold Warriors, is to break up Russia, or in Michael Hudson, the left political economist words, to restore its Yeltsin-Harvard boys managerial kleptocracy. But regardless, we know that there must be a political settlement. In my opinion, it seems Russia's core demands are not outrageous, that Ukraine stay neutral and out of a hostile military alliance and Russia's borders, as well as to recognize the breakaway republics, as well as denazification of the military. The fact that the U.S. officials deem these positions as maximalist and claiming that there's no rush to negotiate seems to be a signal that U.S. officials are happy for this crisis to go on as it suits their interests. You know, we know the military-industrial complex is benefiting and the other geopolitical interests as well from the ongoing conflict, the ongoing crisis, even if and as people are dying. So we should be, we on the left, I think, should be calling for, at this point in time, peace, definitely. But as the Black Alliance for Peace said in their recent statement, and I quote, peace is not merely the absence of conflict. Peace means the achievement through popular struggle and self-defense of a world liberated from militarism and nuclear proliferation, imperialism and unjust war, patriarchy and white supremacy. Peace also means dismantling a military-industrial complex that is clearly profiting from endless war and intervention. So we need to reinvest that bloated military budget into public goods and fighting racialized inequalities in sectors like health and childcare, public housing and transportation, education, as well as the struggle to combat climate devastation. And ultimately, I also agree with the Black Alliance for Peace statement that we need to dismantle NATO for the same reasons we need to abolish the police. Both serve the interests of capital and empire at the expense of the global working classes. And that's a quote from their statement as well.
Karina Mullen, unfortunately, we're running to the end of our allotted time here, but I know that you're involved in the People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism, and I wanted to ask you about that. Can you talk to us about the initiative that you've taken in that respect?
Yes, and I think also we can connect it back to the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia as part of the broader war on Russia. The latest round of sanctions imposed on February 24th, which includes imposed asset freezes on Russian government officials and banks, equity restrictions on Russian mining, transportation, and logistics firms. And already it's having, as well as removing some Russian banks from the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication, SWIFT financial messaging system. Already it's having a devastating impact on the Russian economy and the Russian people. It's, there's been severe currency depreciation, wiping out close to $200 billion in stock market value and roughly a third of the country's sovereign debt. So, you know, we know that this benefits all of the war on Russia and the broader Cold War, which includes the war, Cold War on China, benefits the military-industrial complex. It benefits the financial sector, the oil sector. And so what the People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism is trying to do is really to hone in on the role and the central role of sanctions as a tool of imperialism that really is used to undermine and discipline global South sovereignty and to ensure that the unequal hierarchy within the international system and the persistence of a U.S.-dominated neocolonial capitalist global economy is maintained. And so this tribunal, the tribunal is co-sponsored by organizations that are located throughout the world, including the Committee of Anti-Imperialists in Solidarity with Iran, National Lawyers Guild, the Simon Bolivar Institute for Peace and Solidarity Among Peoples, the International Association for Democratic Lawyers, Al Auda, Palestinian Right to Return, Sami Doun, Palestinian Political Prisoners, Black Alliance for Peace, Answer Coalition, Code Pink, People's Forum, many more. And I just want to say that in collaboration with international scholars and activists and legal experts, the People's Tribunal will host an introductory webinar to discuss the urgent need to take legal actions against U.S. sanctions and economic coercive measures on March 18th at 9:30 a.m. PST time. We'll have a great lineup of speakers, and you can find more information if you email us at info@sanctionstribunal.org, and you can register at https://solidarityiran.org/.
Give that email again, will you please, Karina?
Sure. So the email is info@sanctionstribunal.org.
Excellent. Well, I think that we're going to have to say goodbye, unfortunately. We've run out of time.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today and giving us the perspective of a progressive political economist that very few of us see, certainly not in the corporate media. So thank you so much for joining us, Karina.
Thank you so much for having me, Marjorie and Michael. I really appreciate it and enjoy the conversation.
Every success in your work.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukrainian rescue crews have begun pulling survivors out of the wreckage of a theater in the besieged Ukrainian city of Mariupol after it was hit by a massive explosion Wednesday. The theater was being used as a shelter by hundreds of civilians who've endured more than 2 weeks of near constant shelling by Russian forces with no water, heat, or electricity and dwindling food supplies. Satellite images clearly show the word children written in large letters on the ground on two sides of the theater. Another blast in Mariupol hit a swimming pool where pregnant women and young children had gathered. Elsewhere, Russian forces have been accused of killing at least 10 people standing in line for bread in the northeastern city of Chernihiv. Russia has denied responsibility for the attacks on civilians. The United Nations Development Program Wednesday estimated Russia's assault has already caused over $100 billion in damage to Ukraine's infrastructure. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed a joint session of U.S. Congress by video Wednesday, thanking the United States for its military and humanitarian aid, but asking for more help in defeating Russia's invasion. Zelensky spoke in Ukrainian through an interpreter.
This is a terror that Europe has not seen for 80 years, and we are asking for a reply, for an answer to this terror from the whole world. Is this a lot to ask for, to create a no-fly zone over Ukraine to save people? Is this too much to ask?
U.S. officials continue to rule out a no-fly zone, which could lead to a direct military confrontation between the United States and Russia, two nuclear powers. But on Wednesday, President Biden announced $800 million in new military aid for Ukraine, including over 20 million rounds of ammunition, 100 drones, 2,000 Javelin anti-tank missiles, and 800 Stinger anti-aircraft systems. Biden also made headlines when he called Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal, charges the Kremlin called unacceptable and unforgivable. The Financial Times reports Ukrainian and Russian delegates have discussed a 15-point deal under which Russia would withdraw troops in exchange for Ukraine renouncing its ambitions to join NATO and agreeing not to host foreign military bases or weapons. The World Health Organization's warning of an unparalleled health crisis in Ethiopia's Tigray region, where 6 million people have been sealed off from the outside world for 500 days as separatists battle government forces. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is from Tigray, said Wednesday about three-quarters of health facilities in the region have been damaged or destroyed by fighting.
There is almost no fuel, no cash and no communications. No food aid has been delivered since the middle of December. 83% of the population is food insecure. Our partners are running out of what little food they have and the fuel to transport it.
The United Nations expressed disappointment Wednesday after a conference of international donors raised less than a third of the money needed to prevent a widening humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. The UN had hoped to raise $4.3 billion. Instead, donors pledged just $1.3 billion. Aid agencies warn more than 17 million people in Yemen are in need of food assistance, and more than 160,000 could soon experience famine. This comes more than 7 years into the Saudi-led war and blockade on Yemen, supported by the United States and allies, including the United Kingdom. To see our interview on the issue yesterday, go to democracynow.org. On Wednesday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson traveled to the Saudi capital, where he met with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. As the UK looks for alternatives to Russian oil and gas, Johnson spoke to reporters in Riyadh after the meeting.
I raised human rights, as I'm sure you would expect, but we also talked about what we can do to stabilize oil prices, to fight inflation, to help consumers, to help people at the gas pumps.
Newly released FBI documents reveal a California-based Saudi spy assisted some of the 9/11 hijackers in finding housing in San Diego, and that there was a 50-50 chance he'd advance knowledge of the attack. Omar Al-Bayoumi had claimed he incidentally befriended the two hijackers but was not involved in their planning. The FBI report found Bayoumi regularly shared his intelligence with Saudi Arabia's U.S. Ambassador Prince Bandar bin Sultan Al Saud, who was so close to former President George W. Bush, he earned the nickname Bandar Bush. The report was written in 2017 but only declassified last week. The Biden administration's granted temporary protected status to Afghans in the United States, shielding them from deportation for the next 18 months. The move affects an estimated 74,000 Afghan refugees who fled to the U.S. during the Taliban's rapid takeover last August, plus thousands more already in the United States. Advocates for refugees welcome the move but called on Congress to pass the Afghan Adjustment Act, which would grant Afghans a pathway to lawful permanent status. U.S. coronavirus cases and hospitalizations continue to fall, though more than 1,200 people continue to die of COVID-19 on average per day. On Tuesday, Vice President Kamala Harris skipped an equal pay day event at the White House after her husband, second gentleman Doug Emhoff, tested positive for the coronavirus. The news came just days after former President Barack Obama also reported he has COVID. Both men said they're experiencing mild symptoms. Meanwhile, Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin canceled a planned visit to the White House today after he received a positive coronavirus test result while attending a gala in Washington, D.C. that had just been addressed by President Biden. The Federal Reserve voted Wednesday to raise the benchmark federal funds rate by a quarter percentage point, the first time the Fed has raised the interest rate since 2018. Chair Jerome Powell signaled he expects the Fed to raise interest rates six more times by year's end in order to combat high levels of inflation blamed on the pandemic and rising energy costs from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Colorado House of Representatives passed a bill Monday codifying the right to an abortion and contraceptive care in Colorado. The measure is also expected to pass the Democrat-controlled Senate. The move comes as Republican-led states around the country are attacking reproductive rights and criminalizing abortion, and as the Supreme Court's weighing a case that could essentially overturn Roe v. Wade. In Japan, a powerful 7.4 magnitude earthquake off the coast of Fukushima killed four people and injured 100 others Wednesday. A tsunami alert has been lifted. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, says the quake force cooling systems at the Fukushima Daiichi and Daini nuclear power plants offline for several hours. The cooling systems are critical to preventing a nuclear disaster like the triple meltdown that follows Japan's devastating 2011 earthquake and tsunami. In Haiti, thousands of health workers, including doctors and nurses, held a three-day strike this week to protest a surge in gang-related kidnappings, shutting down hospitals, clinics, and health centers other than for emergency care. Kidnappings in Haiti increased 180% in the past year, though the true number of cases is unknown as many go unreported. Workers with the Association of Owners and Drivers in Haiti said they're launching their own strike to protest gang thefts of vehicles and attacks on public buses. In Mexico, journalist Armando Linares was shot dead Tuesday in his home in the state of Michoacán. No arrests have been made in what is now the eighth assassination of a Mexican media worker this year. Just 6 weeks ago, Armando Linares denounced the murder of his colleague Roberto Toledo, who also worked at the Monitor Michoacán news outlet, saying at the time his team had received death threats.
Today, the threats were ultimately fulfilled. One of our colleagues lost his life at the hands of three people who shot him in a mean and cowardly manner. We are not armed. We do not carry weapons. Our only defense is our pen.
Two high-profile British-Iranian prisoners have arrived back in the UK after being released from an Iranian prison Wednesday. Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe had been fighting her detention for 6 years, denying accusations she was plotting to overthrow the Iranian government. Anousheh Ashoori was arrested while visiting his mother in Iran in 2017 and accused of spying for Israel and, quote, acquiring illegitimate wealth, charges he denied. Ashoori said he was subjected to torture while in prison. And Puerto Rico officially exited bankruptcy Tuesday, nearly 6 years after Congress imposed an outside control board known as PROMESA to run the island's economy. In the largest debt restructuring plan in U.S. history, PROMESA reduced the biggest chunk of Puerto Rico's debt to $7.5 billion from an original $33 billion. But the board's plan required an upfront cash payment of $7 billion to those bondholders, and it also included a swap for $10 billion in new bonds. Still to be resolved is the fate of other portions of Puerto Rico's massive debt, including some $9 billion owed by its electric power authority and $6 billion owed by its highway authority. In addition, the Commonwealth government has already had to pay more than $1 billion in legal and professional fees related to bankruptcy, mostly to U.S. firms. Critics say austerity measures imposed by the Fiscal Control Board will make any economic recovery impossible. Those measures include a nearly 50% cut in the annual budget of the main public university and a requirement that Puerto Rico spend up to $2.3 billion annually to shore up its public employee pension system. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. If you want to make sure you'll never miss a TaxCast, just email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. And let me know what you think of the show. Coming up later.
As each day went by, it became more and more obvious that I was a victim of a huge scam. How any of them can sleep straight in bed at night, I have no idea.
We'll hear how a pensioner was robbed of his dream retirement. He tells of his fight for justice. But first, I'm joined by the Tax Justice Network's Rachel Etapoya in Malawi, who has some really sad news. Rachel?
Yes, today I've got a deeply tragic story to share about a Malawian hero, a tax collector, So over a year ago, Alanafe Bonongwe was moved from the Malawi Revenue Authority to a border post in central Malawi, and he was appointed the station manager there in what we understand was a bid to clean up corruption. Dead the border post is on the Malawi-Mozambique border. Loads of trucks cross the border every day. They're bringing in fuel and goods that have landed at the ports in the region. And smuggling, tax evasion, bribery, fraud, and all sorts of things are huge problems at our borders. And stories are rife of collusion between traders and big business people, the police and tax and customs officials. And the Malawi Revenue Authority has been trying to stamp this out and make sure revenue is not stolen from the people. And this is where Alanafe comes in. He was a family man in his 40s. Nafe was doing his job well and honestly and bravely at Dead the Border Post. And he was starting to close in on some really powerful and politically connected business people involved in Malawi's trucking and trade businesses. Because of this, last year, people attempted to tarnish his image on social media. And that was presumably an attempt to help have him removed from his position. And it didn't work. It didn't deter Alanafe in his quest for justice. But then Alanafe started to receive death threats. And earlier this month, Alanafe was murdered.
That's such a terrible loss for Malawi.
Yes, it really is. The Malawian president paid tribute to him, and he described Alanafe as a warrior of justice who stood up to lawless and corrupt cartels in defense of our national treasures. He really was a warrior of justice.
Yeah, and it's when we lose such good, honest people, we realise how important they were to us. I mean, not just in the work they were doing, but to the heart and the soul of the country.
Yeah, so important. And all over the world, just as here in Malawi, tax collectors are undervalued. They're taken for granted and they're so often poorly paid, aren't they? That really must change. When we lose people like Alanafe, it becomes crystal clear how much they're the lifeblood of our nation. So we offer our heartfelt condolences to Alanafe's family and colleagues. And as the Malawi Revenue Authority has said in his honour, the fight will continue and you have not died in vain, Alanafe.
Thank you, Rachel. The Tax Justice Network's Rachel Etapoya in Malawi. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. We know that so-called blue-collar crime tends to get all the attention, but white-collar crime is seen as somehow more acceptable, less serious. They're men in suits, after all. Well, they're usually men. In this TaxCast special feature, we're going to hear the experiences of one pensioner's fight for justice in multiple jurisdictions. Since there are various legal proceedings in process and still to take place with this case, we're going to call him our pensioner. Here's his story.
I was in the fortunate position of being able to retire relatively early, and it had always been a long-term ambition of ours to try and live permanently in the sunshine somewhere. And we had always put in motion the process of emigrating to the States. We'd already bought a plot in Southwest Florida. So that was where it all started. And then talked to my UK accountant and said, you know, what do I do now about pensions? And they said, well, there are such things as these CURE-OPS.
CURE-OPS is a special pension arrangement. It stands for Qualifying Recognised Overseas Pension Scheme.
Basically, what it is, it's available to any overseas citizens who have worked and lived and earned a pension in the UK, who then, when they go back to their motherland, can transfer their UK pension into one of these CURE-OPS. So one of the things that came to light in the early stages when we were going through the process with an American lawyer to get our green card sorted was we needed to be careful that we didn't get caught in the trap of being taxed in two separate jurisdictions. They were specialist immigration lawyers. He said, I do know that there are other Brits who have taken out CURE-OPS because there is a double taxation treaty between the UK and the US with Malta. So he said, we've got quite a few of our green card holders who have got pensions based in Malta because of this double taxation treaty. And he said, you know, it seems to work fairly well.
If you're getting a sinking feeling at this point, as our pensioner says, hindsight is a great thing.
So on the back of that, I did some Google research, and this was in the early days of Malta having been granted status by HMRC.
HMRC is Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, the British tax authorities.
And I think I'm right in saying that my pension provider was one of the first, or if not the very first, to be granted a license by the MFSA to operate or administer a CureOps.
The MFSA is the Malta Financial Services Authority. Remember that, it'll come up later. Did you know, at the time when you started this whole business, did you know much about Malta as a jurisdiction?
No. Well, no, I mean, the ironic part is that when the subsidiary company in Malta was granted the MFSA license, the MD of the parent company said, anybody that decides to come with us can rest assured that as Malta is a full member of the EU, they will be fully protected by EU law and consumer protection. I thought, yeah, you know, safe as houses, aren't we?
Very reassuring.
Yes, because this was a new venture in Malta, they had set up a contract with the Maltese shell companies to have all the administration of the Maltese pension provider supplied by one of their subsidiary companies in the UK. They were a UK FCA regulated company, so that bit stacked up, except that, of course, when it all started to go belly up, it transpired that this service administrative company was not FCA regulated at all. It was registered in the UK, but was unregulated.
The FCA is the UK's Financial Conduct Authority, the regulator for financial services. So we've got two jurisdictions so far, Malta and the UK. Now enter stage right, the Independent Financial Advisor, the IFA.
I then obviously looked to see, try and find a pension advisor who was specialised in CureOps. This name came up, did my research on that. He said at the outset that he was CII qualified and he was FCA regulated. He claimed that he had the G60 advanced pension transfer qualifications. And the MD of the parent company in the UK, he'd been on various pension advisory boards. His CV, you know, gold-plated in theory, as were the people involved in his Maltese company. You've got a former ambassador who was a lawyer and specialised in financial services. So I, like the hundreds of others who eventually got sucked in, thought, well, this is the way to go. So anyway, the money got transferred and we moved to the States. And so a policy was opened by my trustee company in Malta with one of the big insurers in the Isle of Man, all of whom assured me that they had done due diligence on my advisor. On paper, everything looked hunky-dory.
So now we've got Malta, the UK and the British Crown Dependency of the Isle of Man. And, of course, the IFA, the Independent Financial Advisor.
My IFA assured me that the list of investments that he was going to put in my portfolio were all low risk, which I said, well, you know, I worked really hard to accumulate it, so I don't want to be speculating. So low risk is absolutely fine. He said, no, I assure you that everything will be low risk and this, that and the other.
So our pensioner retires and he starts living the dream in Florida. But only a year later, the first low risk investment from his pension went belly up. That's now subject to legal proceedings involving the UK's Serious Fraud Office. That was soon followed by more of these supposedly low risk investments going bad.
Then there was another one, and then another one, and another one. And I started to ask my highly qualified IFA, you know, what was going on. And he said, oh, no, don't worry about it. He said, all these are sound. It's just they've got cash flow problems. All sounded plausible. You know, he said some of the funds are regulated by the Isle of Man FSA. And so I said, okay. Anyway, I just had a gut feeling then that all was not as it should be. I started to ask pointed questions of my IFA, and he was becoming ever more devious in the replies I was getting. Out of the blue, he said, I am resigning as your IFA, and I wish you luck, but I will not now enter into any further correspondence with you. And at this stage, you know, I was relying on him for information as to what was going on with the suspended funds. Well, I obviously went back to my CureOps provider in Malta and said, you know, what is going on? And I also at the same time sent an email to the admin provider in the UK, because at that stage they were still contracted to provide all the administration for the CureOps in Malta. So they both acknowledged and said, oh, you know, we're sorry to hear this. Leave it with us. And I did leave it with them, and they're still dealing with it.
Our pensioner turned detective. He discovered that his IFA, independent financial advisor, had been suspended by the Chartered Insurance Institute for quite some time.
And the FCA, meantime, had also confirmed that the IFA had never, ever been regulated by them, either as an individual, the various companies which he had set up in various jurisdictions, none of which were regulated anywhere, some of which weren't even registered, just made up a company name and given an address in Italy. And it then transpired much further down the line that all these addresses that he'd given were just accommodation addresses. But anyway, hindsight's a wonderful gift, isn't it?
It is indeed. Scammers do use accommodation addresses. They open letterbox companies in the UK. They trade on Britain's supposed respectability and trustworthiness. We've reported before on the Taxcast about the kind of wild west of Scottish and English limited partnerships. And then Companies House, the UK Companies Registry, is an open joke.
So, I mean, this guy's been operating for a long, long time and has scanned millions and millions and millions in fees and commissions and God knows what, facilitated and enabled by the insurers and indeed by HMRC, because, you know, I've been backwards and forwards with HMRC for goodness knows how long, saying, how can you allow these registered companies to still be operating when the UK Treasury last summer put Malta on its red list as being a jurisdiction which needs treating with great care? Nothing to do with us.
Our pensioner didn't take all this sitting down.
So I then contacted a law firm in the UK, because at that stage, all the administration was still being carried out by the unregulated company in the UK. They, in fairness, were very, very diligent, which is how so much of this information I think I already shared with you came to light about the use of 14 different addresses, the fact that he was never ever regulated in the UK. He denied that he'd lived in the UK, but in fact he was on the electoral register. They used trace agents, you know, the whole nine yards. And of course, as each day went by, it became more and more obvious that I was a victim of a huge scam.
Just as it looked like he was getting somewhere, possibly the worst news of all came from our pensioners' lawyers.
My UK lawyers said, look, although this contract between the CureOps in Malta and the administrative company in the UK says that the contract had been drawn up in accordance with English law, the reality is that, and they took advice from a barrister, because the trustees were based in Malta, the jurisdiction lay in Malta. So it was at that stage that I then appointed the lawyer in Malta to represent me, who has been an absolute star, I have to say. And then he submitted judicial papers, as they call it in Malta, to the courts to say, look, we need to start a litigation case against the Kuros provider in Malta. And he said, I'll tell you now, he said, this will drag on for years. It will end up eventually in the European courts because, he said, everybody here is a friend of a friend of a friend. They have got their friends in all the places where they need them to be to ensure that what happens in Malta stays in Malta.
That is exactly the situation in other small island jurisdictions that we've come across where the conflicts of interest are ridiculous. It's the same thing that you've experienced, so it's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and the same has come in the Isle of Man.
Yes.
Because the insurers are based in the Isle of Man, I've submitted complaints to the Isle of Man Constabulary, the Isle of Man FSA, the Isle of Man Financial Ombudsman Service, and it's the same with the FCA. They all say, well, no, I hear what you're saying, but jurisdiction is in Malta. So they know what's going on, but they just don't want it to stick with them, do they? It's the classic, we'll pass the pass until music stops and hope it doesn't stop with us.
So, I mean, you've got a lot of evidence which you've collected. There's a lot of litigation and a lot of processes that you've gone through. You've tried to pursue justice with HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, Financial Action Task Force, Malta's Financial Services Authority, the Financial Conduct Authority. You've been to your Member of Parliament. You've even been to the police. I mean, obviously, it's a long process and there's been a lot of different aspects. But how would you describe the process of trying to get some kind of justice or some kind of accountability?
Character building.
And then our pensioner unexpectedly discovered he wasn't alone.
We had an email from the Kuros provider in Malta where inadvertently they had put 30 plus people in copy rather than putting us all in blind copy, which was an update from the liquidators of one of the Isle of Man failed funds, basically telling us, you know, good luck with this, you're going to get, you know, half a nothing. I assumed I was no longer the only one who'd been caught up in this. But the provider obviously was desperate not to let it out that there were between 60 and 70 members of just this one Kuros provider who had been advised by this now absconded IFA.
So you got in touch with each other because you realised there were other victims in the email chain.
Yes. Once this infamous email was shared amongst us, myself and one other sort of started basically an action group, for want of a better term. And I got in touch with them and said, look, I've, you know, had lawyers in the UK on it since 2017, lawyer in Malta on it. We're just part of an absolute huge scam in many, many different jurisdictions. And we've been sharing
horror stories.
Horror stories is the right way to describe it.
So can I ask you, I mean, you don't have to answer this at all, but can you give an idea of what you've lost personally?
Personally, well over a million. Well over a million.
Mm.
I mean, I hope to goodness, in one respect, I am one of the biggest losers. Fortunately, it hasn't brought us to our knees. I mean, we've had to move back to the UK, but I mean, I haven't lost everything.
Do you know, I mean, you've been in touch with some of the people that were involved in the same scam that you were. Do you know any of their stories?
Oh, heartbreaking. I mean, there's one lady who was a nurse and is still working as a nurse in the States. And she said, I can't afford to envisage taking out legal action against them because the legal fees involved. And I mean, that is heartbreaking. There is somebody who died destitute in Spain because he had been scammed out of everything. His house was being repossessed and he died just days before the bank was going to take the keys from him. I've shared that with the MFSA and with the police and everybody in Malta saying, you know, how can you allow this to happen and not take action? And the reality is because so many of those people involved are high up in government circles, have been former MPs, are former ambassadors and so on, and they're all just looking after themselves. Truly scandalous.
I mean, in one sense, you could look at this as a story about Malta being a really bad and unsafe jurisdiction to do business. However, you could also say this is also a story about lack of enforcement in many jurisdictions. So you're talking about the Isle of Man, you're talking about the UK, where the company was registered there, and actually that wasn't safe either. So this is not just a story about don't put your money in Malta.
Oh, no. It's basically stick it under your mattress and look after it yourself, because all these people that are meant to be batting for you aren't interested or are incapable or, dare I even suggest it, perhaps facilitating because of the benefits they receive. I mean, certainly that's the case in Malta, and I'm increasingly convinced the same is in the Isle of Man, because you've got exactly the same scenario. Small island, heavily reliant on the financial services. They all know each other. All the auditors will know each other. All the insurers will know each other. And when I've got literally thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of documents, how any of them can sleep straight in bed at night, I have no idea.
I don't know either. And here's a question for you. How would you sum up what is the Malta Financial Services Authority for?
To cover the tracks of the criminals who are operating there.
I thought you might say something like that. And the conflicts of interest run beyond a small island culture where everyone knows everyone. In the Isle of Man, for quite some time, the insurance industry regulator also had a remit to promote the industry. That would cast some doubt on the proper assessment of new applicants wanting to do business there. Now, I know there are good people who work hard for regulators and they try to do the best they can. But we see time and time again that regulators are understaffed, underinvested in, and they often have no teeth. So far, neither the regulators nor law enforcement in the Isle of Man, in Malta or in the UK have dealt effectively with the criminality involved in our pensioners' case.
I've identified 50 plus breaches in law, one of which clearly states that where you can show that the regulated body has willfully neglected to protect your interests, they are obliged to reimburse you in full for the losses you have incurred. No, it's there in black and white. And all that the MFSA has done so far, they've concentrated on the regulatory breaches. They've ignored all the criminal breaches. Because, of course, if they actually go that way, then, of course, it opens up a huge, huge can of worms. And one of the other big things that's been relevant to our scheme is that they have refused to confirm whether they have indemnity insurance. And the MFSA have not confirmed whether they have or haven't. And I fear the fact that nobody is saying so is that perhaps they have, but the insurers have said, well, you know, we're not going to pay out on this because you've been naughty boys, haven't you?
Yeah, that's very likely.
Well, I would think it's very, very, very likely.
Our pensioner had early hopes that the Maltese police might investigate the criminal aspects of his case. After a long wait, his lawyer had a go.
They said that they'd been investigating, you know, and they clearly haven't. He said, well, you know, it's up to you, because if you don't fulfil on the report that you said you were going to make, then I'm going to just take it to the European Court of Law, because my client's human rights to justice are being denied. Within an hour, he had an email back from the assistant commissioner who is in charge of financial crime, saying, oh, you will hear shortly from Superintendent so-and-so on progress that we are making. We are still waiting. I think this will be the end of Malta as a jurisdiction for pensioners, because none of the insurers will now touch it with a barge pole. They won't be able to get insurance for their indemnity liabilities.
What would you say to yourself back then when you were looking at pension options?
If I knew then what I know now, I would have just left my pension with the company.
What do you think has happened to your money and to the money of the other people who have been involved in this scam?
Somebody somewhere is living off it very, very nicely, one of whom no doubt is my now absconded IFA and his family.
They're probably living in Florida.
Well, they quite probably are. You know, they may even have bought the house that we had to sell. You know, the IFA, his company, or his final company, was registered in Panama. So he was having his fees paid into a Barclays account in the Isle of Man, who no doubt have been sending the money to, you know, Panama or Cayman Islands or whatever. And the Isle of Man Constabulary have said, well, there's no reason for us to investigate because there's no evidence of criminal activity. And I said, well, excuse me, I think there is. You know, that money has been paid by Isle of Man registered and regulated insurers. Money taken from our portfolios, and you've been paying fees and commissions. And I mean, my fees for transferring into the policy initially were over £43,000. And then he's had commissions from all these high-risk bonds and God knows what. It's staggering.
It is staggering.
I've gone back to the head of the Economic Crime Unit in the Isle of Man and said, you've got to review this now. You can't now say this is just a regulatory matter. This is a criminal matter. You know, I've spent more than £70,000 on legal fees so far, on top of the money I've lost. And this is why I'm doing so much myself, because if I've been trying to pay lawyers to do it, I want millions to gather the information and the evidence that I've got. But anyway, I'm not giving up.
Thank you to our pensioner for sharing his story with us on the TaxCast. We wish his group of pensioners good luck in their ongoing battles for justice. We've seen so many times that on the surface, so many jurisdictions look good. They've got coats of arms, official bodies with crests above their names, shiny office blocks, oak-panelled meeting rooms and glossy brochures. But when things go wrong, you really can't be sure they'll help you. That's it for this edition of the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.